You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. On this 281st episode of the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about a recent trip that I took down to Virginia. In fact, I'm only about 12 hours away from unloading my rods and reels, and more importantly, dog crates and kids' toys and bags and all of the fast food wrappers out of my car. And why would you want to listen to me talk about a family vacation that I took to Virginia? Well, let me give you a few reasons why. One, this could be a little bit of a travel PSA for the Mid-Atlantic region in general and Virginia in particular, which is a wonderful area to go and a place that's very accessible to a lot of folks. In fact, you can go back in the archives of the podcast, and I have an episode talking about fly fishing in the Shenandoah Valley and fly fishing in the Mid-Atlantic. But I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about a few different aspects of it today. So this is something that is very, very true to exactly where I was, but in a more general sense is true to a broader region. So that's the first thing. Second thing, talk a little bit about appreciating fly fishing in that margin time, the time that you can make it happen. If you're in a stage of life, if you are in a time where you are not going out for multiple days during the week, you're not able to take all of Saturday and go fishing, talk a little bit about how to make that work and ways to optimize that time. Plus, it's also fun for some people to hear about what other people are doing. And it's interesting. Whenever I do podcasts like this, episodes like this, I get a lot of feedback. And it's different feedback. It's feedback from people who live in similar areas and who say, I think you're fishing here. That's great. This is where I fished. Or I fished in this area. I'm not asking you to tell me exactly where you went or what you did or the flies to use or things like that. Just kind of give me some general guidelines and some guidance. And I'm always happy to do that. But once again, I'm not the expert. I'm like lowercase e expert. There's legitimate capital E experts out there that will put you on stuff. At the same time, I found that people will say things like, well, I'm not going to tell you exactly what to use because it's part of the adventure and part of the journey. And you need to know exactly what's happening in that time and the hatch and blah, 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 right? I'm actually okay with saying, you know what? I'd use these four or five flies. There's probably some better things to use out there, but these are four or five things that I would start with, unless there's something landing on your face or flooding around on the water or the fly shop is telling you absolutely use something different. So I'm always happy to give those general suggestions. So when I'm talking about Virginia, what am I talking about? Because Virginia is a very large state. It really is. If you've ever driven on I-81 from where it comes into the northern part of the state from West Virginia and go all the way down to, where's 81 empty out? That's in Tennessee, yeah. Or if you go down to North Carolina, or if you were to even just go all the way down to like the eastern shore of North Carolina, it's a very large state. And there's a lot of water, and a lot of it is fishable. In fact, there are some remarkable and amazing opportunities for fly fishing in Virginia. Whether it be striped bass in the Chesapeake Bay, whether it be big toothy fish in some of the larger rivers as you move over to the West Virginia border, some large bass down in the lakes, down in the south central part of the state. But for all intents and purposes, and I'd be remiss not to mention the smallmouth opportunities in the Potomac and the Shenandoah and some of those other rivers. But today I'm talking about trout. And why am I talking about trout? Well, I'm talking about trout today because I was fishing in the middle of March. And this is a relatively cool march. It was, you know, the week we wanted was the week that happened before we got there. That is to say, the 60 and 70 degree days were there the week before. We took that little 10-day vacation. But I am certainly not complaining about the 50-plus degree weather because it did not snow there. While it snowed up here in New England, and I didn't have to touch any of it or deal with any of it, it did not snow down in Virginia. So I'm definitely happy about that. But why trout? Well, all those other fish species are certainly catchable year-round. I mean, the stripers, of course, you kind of have to wait for them to be there to catch them. But once the fish are there, you can catch them because fish got to eat, right? It might be harder. It might be slower fishing. It might be less comfortable fishing. But you can catch those fish. Trout, you're really able to fish for those fish as long as they are in season, year-round, exactly where you think they're going to be, for two reasons. You have, in the area where I was fishing, the central part of the state, adjacent to the mountains and in the valleys, you have mountain creeks and you have spring creeks. So I only went fishing, kind of capital, or quote-unquote went fishing, twice. And it was really just two half days. But we had a lot of other things going on. And one of those trips was with my boys, my older two, my 12-year-old and my 9-year-old. And we went up into the mountains and we fished a stream I'd never fished before, which is remarkable in itself. Not that I am like super well traveled, but in the area from like Charlottesville north on the Shenandoah National Park, I've spent a lot of time for the last 25 years in those mountains, whether it was when I was in high school or whether when I was living there and breaks in college or even just living there again, like only about 7 or 8 years ago, or just visiting family. I have been in the Shenandoahs a lot. So to fish a stream I'd never fished before, for me, that's exciting, which just goes to show there are so many waters. And in these waters, there are countless, little feeder creeks. So each little river is a watershed unto itself. So you look at these hollows or hollers, if you will, on the maps of any mountain ridge from Georgia all the way up to Maine. You look at any river, any creek, any stream, and there's countless other feeder creeks that flow into them. Some of them may not appear on maps. I had a really, really good day recently, I think it was last season, up in the White Mountains, fishing a stream that I thought, man, this place is awesome. The topography is great. The trout were plentiful, relatively large for their size. I go home thinking, okay, what's the name of this creek? And I had to go back to a hand-drawn map from a long, long time ago, probably when it was completely, raked over from the logging, to find a map with a name on it. It's not on Google Maps. On the DeLorme Atlas I looked at, it was just a little bit of a blue line that was only like a quarter inch long because it was such a small stream. But there's all of these little waters that can all be a part of a larger watershed. Sometimes we think of watersheds as being like the major river that all these trout streams flow into, but at a more micro level, there are smaller watersheds that are worth exploring. So the fact that I was able to get on this one stream and we only fished maybe about a quarter to a half mile of it and got into a chubby brook trout, and brook trout that I was able to have dry fly action on at a relatively cold and windy day. Was pretty exciting. We started off that day, and I was in a fleece and a insulated jacket and chest waders simply for the insulation benefits of that. And this is one of the great things about this area, is that there had been enough warm-ish days, enough sunshine, enough of that, so that we were able to fish dry flies. And the fish wanted to play ball. We had more productive time with dry flies than even on some of my totally dead to rights streamer techniques that I like using on these small streams. The fish were active because the bugs were active because of the nature of these small streams. And this is one of the things where I want to mention earlier. Why would you fish a stream like this? Or why would you get excited about a relatively normal a little mountain trout stream? Well, once you get down to these more southerly climbs, once you get down to certainly southern Appalachia, but the mid-Atlantic, now you start getting into fish that start turning on sooner in the season because they more quickly adapt to those moderately warm days. Up here, I'm sure I could go catch fish, and I know I can catch. I have caught fish this season. I see my friends catching fish this season around here. But once you get down there, they start playing ball in the way that you want to, which really is a treat, especially if you have a limited amount of time. If you say, I want to catch trout on dry flies, then you can go to places like this. You can get a little bit further south, and the fish are going to do kind of what you want them to do. So absolute blast chasing these fish, and again, chasing them on a stream that I'd never fished before. I never hiked it before. I know I'd fished in that watershed, in the greater watershed. It's a river that flows into a little bit of a pond, impoundment, or bigger river, really. And I know I'd fished one of the other major rivers that flows into that as well, but I'd never fished this one. And I wrote an article recently, I'll mention at the end of the podcast, about how you can find new familiar waters, which is to say rivers that feel like you've been there, but you know you haven't been there. And that's one of the treats about fishing in an area that you fished basically your whole life, but finding other rivers that you just, for one reason or another, haven't found your time to explore. And so I was able to do that on this larger brook trout stream in the Shenandoah National Park, an absolute blast. But there's other options too. And in this region, once you go over the river, or excuse me, over the mountain ridge, then you find spring creeks. And really from the, you know, central part of Virginia, all the way up into Pennsylvania. And all, of course, there's outliers further into New York, down into North Carolina, and even further west there, you're going to find a lot of spring creeks. Now, these are limestone creeks. Now, they're not necessarily chalk streams in the most strict sense of the word that you're going to think about when you look at those streams in, you know, in England. And even some of the streams that you're going to find in the region, South Central Pennsylvania, for example. But there are a number of creeks that are significantly influenced by springs, whether they bubble up from a hole in the ground or whether they are influenced by springs, because there are a number of freestone creeks that converge and then they receive a significant spring influence, changing their characteristics significantly because of that the geology and because of the water temperature and everything that comes with that, where you get a more consistent flow rate, a more consistent flow temperature, and consequently you get a more consistent food source for these fish, where they are not having to deal with the seasonality and the fluctuations that come with that as much as fish in freestone streams. And so I was able to get down and fish one of these streams, and there's a number of them. There's some really popular ones and there's some less known ones. There's some big ones. I mean, you know, real deal casting, and I was able to bomb out some long casts, which was awesome. You know, you find these rivers in the mid-Atlantic that are smaller, but they're in pastures, they're in fields, and you're able to actually have a real cast where you're only having to make sure that there's not that one lone tree behind you that sometimes you find in the field. And when you find that tree, it's usually the one you get hung up in, but you're able to locate that tree and then make totally normal casts. And here I was looking for larger fish. And so I was fishing streamers all day. There was one time where I thought I saw a splashy rise, and I stared for, no joke, 5 minutes at this one spot, just wanting to see this fish rise again, because I thought, you know what? I don't care if this is a 6-inch fish. I want to catch this fish on a dry fly. And I watched and watched and watched, and nothing happened. I was standing still enough that a muskrat came within a few feet of me, and a fox ran right, like maybe 10 or 12 feet in front of me. But I stood there for 5 or 7 minutes just waiting for this fish to rise again. But it decided to not rise. Or maybe it wasn't even a fish. Maybe it was like an acorn that fell in the water. Like I said, I wanted to catch a larger fish. So I told my wife that morning. She said, what do you want to accomplish today? She likes to tell me that so that I don't know, I have a goal. What do you want to accomplish today? I said, I want to catch a nicer fish. I said, well, I hope you catch one nice fish. I'll pray you catch one nice fish. And I caught two nice fish. I caught two decent sized brown trout chasing streamers. And they both, well, one came charging out from under a bank, and it hit it and missed it and came back again. And you absolutely love that. And here's there's going to be a couple of technique pieces in this part of the podcast. Whenever a fish hits a streamer, you're going to have the tendency to, one, you've probably already tried to set the hook. And so now you've pulled that fly maybe a foot, maybe 3 feet away from where that initial strike was. And you may have the tendency to continue that motion backwards, pulling that fly further out of the water and maybe into another cast, which isn't the worst thing again, because you can maybe plop that right back down in the exact same spot that that fish turned and hit. But if you can, just let that thing hang there. Even if it's 2 or 3 feet away, that fish is going to come out and potentially hit it again. Now, is there odds, you know, the fish chasing a fly that plops back down in the exact same spot that it missed, or it running 3 or 4 feet to chase the fly that has now like jerked away really fast? Well, I think from a predatory response standpoint, the much more natural thing is for that fish to chase that fly, even though you've pulled it out of its mouth. And, you know, if a fish gets stung, if it really feels that tension or resistance, it's not going to be as prone to chase that fly down. But if at all possible, just let it sit for a beat and maybe even start a slower retrieve, because that predatory response to that fish is, I missed this thing. Do I want to take the chance to go after again? Especially because it's already taken that step from going out of its cover, going out of its structure, going out from its safe place to chase after this bait. And now that it is looking more wounded, it's already done what, you know, if this thing's eaten minnows before, it's stunned the thing and it knows this is kind of what happens, knows, of course, being used very loosely. Now it might go chase it again and go after it. So my suggestion, if at all possible, is to have that discipline to not recast right away. So caught one fish that way. And honestly, was that because I was doing it on purpose? I think it was probably because I just didn't react fast enough where it hit it once and then it kind of popped out into my continued retrieve and it chased and hit it again. And then the second fish, it was just in this plunge pool, for a lack of a better term. A lot of these areas have, you know, old mill situations, whether it be just a farm that had a mill or even just a homestead that had a mill. And even if they have been taken down either by conservation groups, either by new homeowners, or by, you know, the just time has allowed it to wash over this concrete abutment or this stone dam or kind of mill race that was created, there's still going to be a little bit of a plunge on a otherwise smooth flowing stream. And this one just, I mean, it looked like the fishiest spot in the world. I had to get sneaky because it was kind of, you know, gas station bathroom size. It was a small pool, but I was able to kind of sneak up and drop a fly in with the bone arrow cast. So the opposite of that long bombing cast I was waxing so romantically about earlier. I dropped it right into it, and it came up and hit it. And I mean, I saw that thing's tail before I even knew that it had hit my fly. That's how quickly it turned around on it and was able to land him. But as I was sliding down the bank to land that fish, I have a handful of thorns. I'm still finding them. They're moving their way to the surface. But I was sliding down the bank to get this fish and grabbed onto the closest branch, and it had some prickers to it. So I'm looking at one right now, right in the top middle of my middle finger, my right hand. So was it worth it? Absolutely. But then I missed a fish. And isn't it the way of an angler to think about the fish that you missed? So certainly I missed a lot of fish that I didn't even know were going about things. But I found one stretch where there was a really deep run. And when I'm fishing spring creeks in particular, I like to position myself so that I can fish both the downstream swing and the upstream return, even if it's a narrow stream. And when you have a fast enough current, it's about figuring out that ratio of how quickly it's pulling your fly downstream, but also having the right weight on the fly so it's not up on the surface. It can have a little bit of suspension or even bouncing along the bottom of that creek, where you're able to let line out. So you're able to maintain contact with your fly line as you are letting line out on kind of a modified swing. So you're swinging the fly, but you're also allowing it to take out a little bit more line. So you have a few things to think about. One, where's that fly in the water column? Two, what's the line around your feet doing? And three, is it hitting what you're feeling? Is it hitting the end of its swing, these kind of intermittent short swings? Or is there actually a fish on the end of the line? And once you hit certain spots, another thing I like doing this way. So again, let me set the stage. So you're looking at, say the river's flowing from left to right, and you're looking at it. Maybe it's a 20-foot wide creek, and you have an undercut bank in front of you, or maybe even on the near side with you. You know, you cast this fly out, and then you start allowing it to pull a little bit of line out. So it's swinging from directly in front of you, kind of over to 2 o'clock. And then at that point, you allow it to pull some line out of your rod tip and through your fingers. And so now, because it is flowing with the current, it's not just moving, continuing at that kind of 2 o'clock angle, but it's moving more up towards one because it's being pulled with the current away from you, both upstream or downstream and towards the bank. And then you repeat that same thing. So it's kind of this intermittent fan-like stripping and letting line out. great for radio, right? But you're allowing that line to pull itself out while at the same time maintaining contact and imparting a little bit of side-to-side action of that streamer moving down through the water. It works with streamers. It works through with wet flies as well. And then once you hit the terminal end, once you either let so much line out that it becomes unmanageable, or more often than not, you've hit a point where there's a bend in the river, there's some sort of obstruction, there's a rock, there's a branch, you need to stop that kind of presentation because you're going to get in trouble. Then you can always just retrieve it slowly. And at this point, it usually kind of comes at almost that 3 o'clock position where it is wherever your rod tip is. So, that fly is almost never going to be closer to you than your rod tip is. So if you have that rod tip pointing straight out, it's whatever that is, 9 feet away in the current coming back towards you. If you're able to quarter it downstream, which presents some issues with hook setting and with sensitivity, but then now it's maybe, 4.5 feet close to you. Well, anyway, I was doing this and I was thinking about all sorts of things, and then all of a sudden the line gets tight and I see flashes. And so this fish hit multiple times and I did not hook it. And the primary reason was I wasn't paying attention. Secondary reason was I trout set. So I lifted that rod up high like I would if I was fishing a dry fly or a nymph or a more traditional streamer presentation, but I was stripping this thing back in. And of course, strip setting is the way to go. So, you get that tension and you give a nice hard jerk before you, you feel that fish with your line hand. So for me, with my rod in my right hand, line in my left hand, down kind of next to each other, feeling that fish tugging with my left hand on that line, that would be the point at which I would have set the hook. But I did it backwards because my mind was not in the game. As much as I anticipated there being a fish there, I wasn't thinking I was going to catch a fish. And isn't that, again, often the way it happens? So the cool thing about this is that I was able to do both of these things like a day apart from each other in a relatively cold weather. That morning, it was 25 degrees. On the side of the mountain I woke up on, it was 35 degrees, and I get to the parking lot, and it was 25 degrees. Another angler and I were just commiserating about how we were not well prepared. Thankfully, I had left a fleece strapped to my fishing pack from the day before when I'd used my fishing pack for a hiking pack, which, you need to be in the business of multitasking your gear when you are on family vacation. You can't bring everything. You bring the most essential things, and you find things that you can use in multiple different ways. And that was certainly the what I got to do. But I was able to stay warm, and I was able to fish how I wanted to fish, which, again, I feel is a unique situation for a lot of anglers in the world. I'm not in a place where I can do that now. Here in New England, I'm not able to fish however I want to fish. Right now, as I speak, it's like 42 degrees and raining. Even if the rain were to clear up, I wouldn't be able to cast dry flies in the places I wanted to catch brook trout. And you know what? There's not a lot of spring creeks around here. There's a couple, but not in the same way that there is down there. And so this is kind of a special part of the world. It's a special part of the country, and it's a place that I have truly enjoyed getting to know more and more over the decades. So hopefully there's some beneficial things that you have picked up in these 20 minutes. If you are in this area, I would just encourage you, if you have only fished the same river, try a new river. No matter where you are, think about what I said about exploring that watershed. Go up to that next branch. Fish that little feeder creek. There's times where what's trickling into that stream and you step over every time, if you were to just follow it up the hillside, it's going to open up and at least give you 100 yards, maybe 200 yards of fishable water. It's definitely worth doing. And if you've driven over stream A to get to stream B your whole life, why not stop and try stream A? It might not have the same special regulations. It may not have the same notoriety. It may not have the same reputation, but give it a shot. And you'll be surprised sometimes at the benefits that that come with that relative unknown status of that stream. So that's the first thing. The second thing is remember to pay attention. Remember to pay attention to how you fish and expect to catch fish. And hopefully a couple of those techniques that I shared on my experience of fishing the Spring Creek, things that I know but don't always practice, can be beneficial. If you have questions about that that streamer courting your way downstream presentation, let me know. Maybe that warrants an entire episode or podcast, but it's a very, very effective way to fish streamers to undercut banks and to fish that would be very, very wary because you're able to make presentations pretty far downstream from yourself as long as there's nothing in the way. If you fish this area, if you have questions about it, if you just want to talk to me about it, let me know. Matthew@castingacross.com. Always happy to get feedback from folks who fish the same places that I do. this week on Casting Across. The first article is called Time in a Bottle, and it's about the idea of, you know, you're not going to look back on your life and regret the fact that you woke up early to go fishing. You will the week later, the month later, when life gets busy, think, you know, I should have fished a little bit more if I had the chance to. Now, this isn't to say that you eschew other responsibilities and aspects of your life, but what it is saying is that if you're given the choice between going for the gold or going for the silver, there's really no reason to not go for the gold. So looking back, take those opportunities, wake up. It is early, it is cold, it is maybe a little bit harder, but being the first one on the water and maybe being on the water a little bit more is going to be the thing that you enjoy when you look back on it all. And then Wednesday's article is called Coming Back to New Water. And this is what I alluded to earlier. And the seemingly paradoxical name of this article is perhaps what got it the pop that it did. But this is fishing, you know, the valley next to the valley you usually fish. Fishing the river next to the river you usually fish. There's so many things that are the same, but they're somewhat different. And there's something fun, but at the same time, confidence boosting about that. Where, again, if I fish a brook trout creek in the Shenandoah National Park, or even in the Appalachians, period, I have a general idea of what I'm going to do. But I'm also going to be surprised and excited by this new pool that I've never seen before, this new rock formation, or maybe even just the things that are a little bit peculiar about this river. It could be just the direction that it faces when it comes to the sun, and so the bugs come off a different time, or the flowers bloom a different time. These are things that are all exciting and really add to the angling itself. This week's recommendation on the podcast is something I've talked about multiple times. It's the Flytrap XLT Pro Series. And this is my favorite gear organizing system that you can add to your waders, you can add to your pocket, you can add to your backpack, you can add to your vest, your chest pack, your sling pack, whatever you use to keep your fishing stuff. You need this to keep your most essential things at hand. Particularly as I'm doing what I just talked about doing, which is bouncing from stream to stream, and I can't carry all of my gear on a trip. I take my most essential things, and it comes with me where I need it, when I need it. So I have a couple of these, and one is rigged up for spring creek trout, one is rigged up for mountain trout. I've got another one that's rigged up for bass, another one that I even use for saltwater. So I'm actually going to put a link to the Amazon page, because this is actually a great way to see the thing in action. And grab it if you want it right away at the show notes or this podcast page. However, if your fly shop carries it, I would absolutely suggest that you go check it out. And if they don't, say, hey, why don't you carry this thing? I hear it's really good. If you have more questions about it, let me know. It is an absolutely essential piece of gear that for under $20, you really cannot beat. There's a place for your flies, a place for your tools, a place for your tippet. Anything and everything you could want is right there on the Flytrap XLT Pro Series. And I've been using it for years and years, even back before it was pro, when it was the Flytrap Amateur Series. I was using it and I loved it then. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe to your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.